Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we've got Sean back with us. Welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
And so we missed you last week or the last segments, but that's okay. We just kind of plowed forward, and now we're really towards the very end of the Constitution. In other words, the Constitution is pretty much formed, but we haven't hit that point where the amendment protection clauses are added. There's still some issues that need to be pounded out. But I want to give everybody a reminder, warning, that in the Constitutional Convention, they weren't going through what each line meant, or they weren't taking any time to say, okay, now it's our job to make sure that we all have a very clear narrative so that we can sell this, you know, this pig to America. In other words, there was no coercion or collaboration between the delegates in trying to wordsmith and use, you know, playing with the language of how to sell this Constitution. Folks, you read through this and you're going to see that these men were working in making this Constitution better as much as they could do for the time that they had. And they realized there were certain things that they wanted to insert, and the idea of an amendment protection clause is just around the corner. So the fact is that what we're looking at is literally the framers in the process of having no interruptions, literally being able to have their sleeves rolled up and, you know, their implements of constitutional construction, you know, paper, pens, and so forth, and maybe even books. They may have even had some books to refer to, you know, regarding, you know, probably towards the beginning when they talked about theories and so forth. The fact of the matter is, what these men did was they created a government that still stands today as an amazement and a testament to the world what can happen by the influence of our Creator, the divine hand of providence. At the end of this, and as these men went their merry way, they all asserted, and in Congress, they basically affirmed that they wanted to recognize the Constitution in a proclamation of thanksgiving as a gift from the divine hand of providence. They all recognized that. There was never a recanting. Believe me, friends, if there was a letter out there from any of these men that said, you know, we were in the grasp of evil, you know, we never really did, you know, have inspiration from the divine hand of providence, nothing like that at all. And this is important because over time, you know, if there's somebody that has a conscience or what have you, and these men were men with consciences, they would actually speak out on things that really bothered them. And we've even covered some of those things. So my point is this, is that there is no evidence whatsoever that what these men were asserting was anything but what they truly believed to be true. And that right there, my friends, is a very powerful testament of, if you look at how many delegates were in this convention, what they produced, and as you look at this and as you examine this, the checks and balances that were baked into this, that some of them didn't even appreciate that that's what they were doing. They were just creating a you know, wow, and since we have full control, let's make it so that the militia has to enforce the laws, not the federal government creating a standing army. That's brilliant. Let's go to September 10th, and let's look at the topics du jour, because they're going to be talking about the Constitutional Convention. Now, I didn't cover, you know, the ins and outs of the convention language in the Constitution, but at one point in time, they removed it. And at this point in time, it came up to say, you know, let's, and I think it may have been prior to this where they decided to reinsert it. And so they were working, I believe this is where they're just working on the language, but what I want to do is kind of read through what they were doing with Article 5 and how they were basically, because right now they went into, they were calling this Article 9. Or no, my mistake. That's Article 19. So, in other words, the Style Committee still hadn't formed the Constitution into 7 articles. But they were creating the language of what was going to go into Article 19 or Article 5. And so why don't we just pick it up from the beginning, Sean? And again, welcome back.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Gary moved to reconsider Article 19 vis-a-vis, quote, on the application of the legislatures of 2/3 of the states in the Union for an amendment of this Constitution. The legislature of the United States shall call a convention for that purpose. See August 6th. This Constitution, he said, is to be paramount to the state constitutions. It follows, hence, from this article that 2/3 of the states may obtain a convention, a majority of which can bind the Union to innovations that may subvert the state constitutions altogether. He asked whether this was a situation proper to be run into.
Okay, so then Mr. Hamilton basically piped in. You know,
Mr. Hamilton seconded the motion, but he said with a different view from Mr. Gary. He did not object to the consequence stated by Mr. Gary. There was no greater evil in subjecting the people of the United States to the major voice than the people of a particular state. It had been wished by many and was much to have been desired that an easier mode for introducing amendments had been provided by the Articles of Confederation. It was equally desirable now that an easy mode should be established for supplying defects which will probably appear in the new system. The mode proposed was not adequate. The state legislatures will not apply for alterations, but with a view to increase their own powers. The national legislature will be the first to perceive and be most sensible to the necessity of amendments and ought also to be empowered. Whenever 2/3 of each branch should concur to call a convention, there could be no danger in giving this power, as the people would finally decide in the case. Okay. Mr. Madison remarked on the vagueness of the terms, quote, call a convention for the purpose, end quote, a sufficient reason for reconsidering the article. How is a convention to be formed? By what rule decide? What the force of its acts?
Okay.
On the motion of Mr. Gary to reconsider, New Hampshire was divided, Massachusetts aye, Connecticut aye, New Jersey no, Pennsylvania aye, Delaware aye, Maryland aye, Virginia aye, North Carolina aye, South Carolina aye, and Georgia aye.
Almost unanimous that Mr. Gary reconsider this motion for 2/3. Because what Madison was basically stating was, you know, what are the reasons for this? And how was the convention to be formed? By what rule decided? What the force of its acts? So forth. So I think Madison was looking for pounding out really good details in Article 5 to lay out exactly how this convention would be formed and how it would behave, putting that language in there. I mean, when you look at the Electoral College and the selecting of the president, they went into the details of how to do that, and this was lacking that. So anyway, they basically said, okay, let's reconsider this. So Mr. Sherman then made a motion. Go ahead.
Mr. Sherman moved to add to the article, quote, or the legislature may propose amendments to the several states for their approbation. but no amendments shall be binding until consented to by the several states.
Okay, so at this point in time, they had used the language three-fourths. So it would require three-fourths of the states for ratification. Go ahead, keep going.
Mr. Gary seconded the motion. Mr. Wilson moved to insert two-thirds of before the word several states, on which amendment to the motion of Mr. Sherman. New Hampshire, aye. Massachusetts, aye. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, aye. Delaware, aye. Maryland, aye. Virginia, aye. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, no. Georgia, no.
Okay, so actually, Massachusetts was a no, not an aye. And so it was 6-5. In other words, it failed. In other words, they didn't think that the bar was high enough, that two-thirds would not be sufficient. So then Mr. Wilson moved to insert three-fourths before the several states. And then that was agreed to, no contest. Okay, so Mr. Madison then made a motion. Let's go ahead.
Mr. Madison moved to postpone the consideration of the amended proposition in order to take up the following. Quote, the legislature of the United States, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem necessary, or on the application of two-thirds of the legislatures of the several states, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part thereof, when the same shall have been ratified by three-fourths at least of the legislatures of the several states, or by conventions in three-fourths thereof, as one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the legislature of the United States.
Okay.
Mr. Hamilton seconded the motion.
Yes. Okay, so you see what they just did. That right there is very close to the language. What Madison just put in was he put in this added ratification process. In other words, everybody kind of hoodwinked, now Congress can bypass the legislature and take it to the people to ratify in conventions. In other words, the people get to choose their delegates who are going to go into convention instead of allowing the cabal sitting at the trough of power currently to decide whether they're going to allow it or not, to let the people decide who they want to ratify it for them. In other words, it becomes a big signal to the people that Congress isn't trusting the legislatures at this point in time. This is why, one of the reasons why the Anti-Federalist highlighted the fact that it was in convention instead of the state legislatures for ratification, because they weren't being trusted, and they let people know, see, they don't even trust us. Rightfully so. But anyway. Okay, so Mr. Rutledge, after Hamilton seconded it, Mr. Rutledge then made some comments regarding property amendment protection clause. Now, Mr. Rutledge, I believe, is from a southern state. You want any bets on that?
I would say so.
It's okay, but actually, now that I think about it, because I think what he's really trying to do, I'm going to say he's probably from a northern state now. Let me see here. Where is Rutledge? South Carolina. Yep, he is a southern state. So he's trying to maintain. So this is where the first language of the Amendment Protection Clause begins. And what he's trying to do is he's trying to make sure that the slaves remain property. And I think what ends up happening is the language that we get in ensuring that the slave trade be shut down. So let's go ahead and go through this.
Mr. Rutledge said that he said he could never agree to give a power by which the articles relating to slaves might be altered by the states not interested in that property and prejudiced against it. In order to obviate this objection, these words were added to the proposition. Provided that no amendments which may be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the fourth and fifth sections of the seventh article, the postponement being agreed to on the question of the proposition of Mr. Madison and Mr. Hamilton as amended. New Hampshire was divided. Massachusetts, aye. Connecticut, aye. New Jersey, aye. Pennsylvania, aye. Delaware, no. Maryland, aye. Virginia, aye. North Carolina, aye. South Carolina, aye. And Georgia, aye.
Okay, so now Mr. Gary moves forward. So what they're basically, and I don't know what the fourth and fifth sections are, but we will go through this again a little bit later on when they actually have the language in there. And when Connecticut, I think Mr. Sherman was the one that said, we want an amendment protection clause to make sure that the state legislatures never lose their suffrage in the U.S. Senate. And we want to add that to Article 5. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but that's ultimately what they did. So let's go ahead and go into Mr. Gary's comments.
Mr. Gary moved to reconsider Article 11 and Article 12, from the latter of which, quote, for the approbation of Congress, had been struck out. He objected to proceeding to change the government without the approbation of Congress as being improper, giving just umbrage to that body. He repeated his objections also to an annulment of the Confederation with so little scruple or formality.
Okay, then Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Hamilton concurred with Mr. Gary as to the indecorum of not requiring the approbation of Congress. He considered this as a necessary ingredient in the transaction. He thought it wrong also to allow 9 states as provided by Article 11. To institute a new government on the ruins of the existing one. He would propose as a better modification of the two articles, 11 and 12, that the plan should be sent to Congress in order that the same, if approved by them, may be communicated to the state legislatures to the end that they may refer it to the state conventions. Each legislature declaring that if the convention of the state should think the plan ought to take effect among 9 ratifying states, the same should take effect accordingly.
Okay. So this is how they transitioned from the Articles of Confederation with 9 states forming the new government. So the question was, what happened to the old states? Well, the old states, would still be governed by the Articles of Confederation. It would be a smaller, much smaller confederation, but it would also be much more expensive. Because now when you look at the states, if Pennsylvania, where the Continental Congress is currently meeting, is no longer within their realm of the Confederation, they need to find a new place. They need to, accordingly travel, send their delegates there, and continue to function under the Articles of Confederation. But what really ended up happening was, after the Constitution was ratified, well, Continental Congress, because Pennsylvania was one of the states that ratified, there was no earmark for where Continental Congress would convene when the new federal government would form in 1789. So at that point in time, the Continental Congress and the Articles of Confederation were literally in limbo. The onus was on the remaining states to organize and to move forward. Those remaining states were North Carolina and Rhode Island, because ultimately 11 states ratified. After New Hampshire, Virginia was the 10th, New York was the 11th. So there were 2 states that had the onus of creating the new Continental Congress and a place to hold it and everything else. And with only 2 states, it almost seemed, help me out here, it seemed ridiculous. Every other year we would meet in each other, we'll meet in your state, then the next year you meet in our state, and as a Congress, really? The idea of trying to form a confederation of 2 states almost became ridiculous. It didn't mean that they couldn't do it, but the onus would be on them to do it and make it successful. You see my point?
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. I mean, even considering the states aren't even touching. So
yeah, right. So
that would be kind of tough.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. So North Carolina ended up ratifying at the end of 1789, while Congress was still in this first year of its session. And they had an election, and they ended up sending a congressman and senators into that first session of the House as well as the Senate. So they were just a year behind. Rhode Island took a couple more years. They, you know, they didn't care if they were all alone, but all of a sudden they started realizing after the Bill of Rights and everything else was happening, and I think there were some innuendos that, you know, maybe we should just take over Rhode Island. Maybe, you know, maybe it just shouldn't be a, you know, this puny state. It's so small, it's just ridiculous to consider it a state. So who gets Rhode Island? And, you know, and whoever's closest, right? Anyway. Okay, so Mr. Gorham then pipes in, and let's go ahead and read these down through Mr. Randolph.
Mr. Gorham, some states will say that 9 states will be sufficient to establish the plan. Others will require unanimity for the purpose, and the different and conditional ratifications would defeat the plan altogether. Mr. Hamilton, no convention convinced of the necessity of the plan will refuse to give it effect on the adoption by 9 states. He thought this mode less exceptional than the one proposed in the article and would attain the same end. Mr. Fitzsimmons remarked that the words, quote, for their approbation had been struck out in order to save Congress from the necessity of an act inconsistent with the Articles of Confederation under which they held their authority.
Okay, so Mr. Gorham basically felt that many states would not ratify because they felt it would require, you know, a unanimous ratification, like the Articles of Confederation. However, everybody knows that was the huge problem and why they had to create this convention in the first place. So the reality is, every state that ratified, whether they wanted the unanimity or not, and oh, by the way, the two states that had caveats, one state, I think it was Delaware. We'll go through this later, but I think it was Delaware. And I forget what the other state was. If you remember, by all means, it might have been Massachusetts, that wanted to make sure that, you know, the unanimity, in other words, every state had to agree. Well, they went ahead and threw aside the Articles of Confederation and ratified to basically jump into the new union. Both states that had any reasons for, you know, rejecting the Constitution because they had very specific requirements, felt that those requirements were addressed and went into the new union. Again, only 2 states were left out. And technically, the only reason New York ratified had nothing to do with Hamilton's prowess and, you know, his vernacular and his reasoning and debate skills. It had everything to do with New York didn't want to see the Union move forward and it not have a proper position as a large state in the Union. So in other words, because Virginia ratified, New York felt obligated. And that's exactly what Hamilton was banking on. So towards the end of the debates in New York, it was kind of, Virginia's ratified, so I guess maybe we won't ratify and watch Virginia have all the presidencies and watch Virginia, you know, amass all the power. Hamilton being the little manipulative creature that he was. Anywho, so Mr. Randolph then goes ahead and opines on this, and we can move forward all the way down to, let's do down to Mr. Hamilton.
Right when we come back from the break, sir.
Oh, yes, sir. We're literally at that point. Thank you so much for pointing that out. Time flies when I'm having fun. Anywho, folks, as you can see, they're kind of dealing with some of these are the final details that they're still just trying to smooth out. And there's literally 1 week left from the 10th to the 17th. There's 1 week left before it's all said and done. And so they're doing the due diligence in making sure every T's crossed, every I is dotted. We'll be right back after this break.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
So, before we move forward, I got a question for you. Because we see this in contract law. We see how the language is very specific that, you signed a contract, and so you're bound by that contract, even though you may not have realized that you signed away inalienable rights. So here's the question. Can a person in the United States, or can a state in the United States, surrender via signing a contract, surrender inalienable rights, rights of sovereignty, rights, that are given by God?
No.
Okay. Because we see all the time, and this is one of the things I'm going to try to bring up, but it doesn't get addressed due to the fact that the Constitution kind of cleaned up the admission of states. When we look at Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution in admitting new states, there is nowhere in there delegating Congress any power whatsoever to be able to influence or allow. Let me just say this. You're sitting there, you're a federal government, and you only have the authority to have forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings. That is it. And a state comes along and says, we have this beautiful land. We want to make this a national treasure. So we want you to have this and create a national park out of Yellowstone. And they grant that to the federal government. Can the federal government take that?
Let's say under the Constitution, no, they cannot.
That's right. They can't, because you have to amend the Constitution for them to have the power to possess that type of land. There you go. See, that's an awesome job, because most people would have said, of course, if you want to surrender. But I led off with, so most people should have had some, some concern over, this might be a trick question, because it kind of was. I didn't mean it to be that way. But the point is that, no, you cannot. You cannot just go and give up. That's one of the reasons why the necessity of the 14th Amendment and the second clause in Section 1. No state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. That means their inalienable rights cannot be taken from them. The concept and the spirit of this Constitution is that states and people and the people's government will always have the liberty of self-determination as long as it stays in line with the Constitution in protecting everybody's sovereignty and liberty. That makes sense, right?
Absolutely.
Doesn't that seem divine?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And that's the way I always think about it. And I don't know where I came across it, but I always say you can't take someone's freedom. Your freedom has to be surrendered. And people say, they can put you in jail, they can do this. Yeah, but they're still not taking it. I mean, I'm not surrendering it. It's the same thing like with the gospel. People can try to stop you from worshiping.
You know,
they can't take it from you.
I'd like to caveat that. You can't really surrender it. You can choose not to exercise it and use it. You can choose not to.
But it's still yours, right?
It will always be yours. You can always stand up and say, kill me. I'm not doing this anymore. If that be the consequence, kill me. I'm not your puppet anymore. And voila, you've now taken that power back because you always have that ability. But the fear of life, and, you know, he knows. I mean, the Creator knows what's going on. He knows what's happening and, you know, the threats and so forth. But he's constantly advised us to endure to the end. Never surrender. Never surrender. Stand up and demand. You know, and if you get thrown in the den of lions, he will perform a miracle. Anyway, especially if it's his will. So, anywho, well, this guy had it coming. anyway, let's pick up with Mr. Randolph. Thank you so much.
Mr. Randolph declared, if no change should be made in this part of the plan, he should be obliged to dissent from the whole of it. He had from the beginning, he said, been convinced that radical changes in the system of the Union were necessary. Under this conviction, he had brought forward a set of Republican propositions as the basis and outline of a reform. These Republican propositions had, however, much to his regret, been widely and, in his opinion, irreconcilably departed from. In this state of things, it was his idea, and he accordingly meant to propose, that the state conventions should be at liberty to offer amendments to the plan, and that these should be submitted to a second general convention with full power to settle the Constitution finally. He did not expect to succeed in this proposition, but the discharge of his duty in making the attempt would give quiet to his own mind.
Okay, so right here, Mr. Governor Randolph laid out his excuse for not signing the Constitution and opposing it. The irony is that between this point in time to the beginning of the convention, Governor Randolph had a change of heart. Because he saw what was happening in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania being the first state to actually offer amendments. Massachusetts made it a formal part of their convention. And so almost all states moving forward tried to prove that they were just as, you know, omnipotent as the first two, and tried to make, you know, word changes to the amendments that they provided. Oh, look, we've worded it better. Anyway, so the point I'm bringing up here is that when we look at what Governor Randolph has done right here, it gave him pause to basically, and I think that this, I don't know the man's mind. Maybe he was doing this because he didn't want to get land-based going back as the governor saying, how could you do this? By the state legislature. How could you sign up for something like this? Because I think he knew that the state legislature sentiments would be adamantly against this, which they were. And so somehow between this comment, this statement in the convention to going into the ratification debates, the anti-federalists grilled him in the ratification debates. How dare you change your position? How in good conscience can you say that and now say this? So he made his own bed and he had to, you know, live in it. And he made some great contributions in the ratification debates, which we will prove to you and show you. But let's go ahead with Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Wilson was against a reconsideration for any of the purposes which had been mentioned.
Okay, Mr. King.
Mr. King thought it would be more respectful to Congress to submit the plan generally to them than in such a form as expressly and necessarily to to require their approbation or disapprobation. The assent of 9 states be considered as sufficient, and that it was more proper to make this a part of the Constitution itself than to provide for it by a supplemental or distinct recommendation.
Okay. Mr. Gary.
Mr. Gary urged the indecency and pernicious tendency of dissolving in so slight a manner the solemn obligation of the Articles of Confederation. If 9 out of 13 can dissolve the compact, 6 out of 9 will be just as able to dissolve the new one hereafter.
Okay.
Mr. Sherman was in favor of Mr. King's idea of submitting the plan generally to Congress. He thought 9 states ought to be made sufficient, but that it would be best to make it a separate act and in some such form as that intimated by Colonel Hamilton, than to make it a particular article of the Constitution.
Okay.
On the question for reconsidering the two articles, 11 and 12, New Hampshire was divided, Massachusetts no, Connecticut aye, New Jersey aye, Pennsylvania no, Delaware aye, Maryland aye, Virginia aye, North Carolina aye, South Carolina no, and Georgia aye.
Okay, so that's, 7-3. So apparently one state is not present, and that state that's not present, or at least not voting, is New York. And Mr. Hamilton's obviously there, but I guess they weren't giving him a sole vote. There had to be somebody he had to agree with them. And so, or maybe, well, actually they would have said it would have been divided. But anyway, so let's go into what Mr. Hamilton now proposes.
Mr. Hamilton did move to postpone Article 11 in order to take up the following, containing the ideas he had above expressed. Resolved that the foregoing plan of a constitution be transmitted to the U.S. in Congress assembled, in order that if the same shall be agreed to by them, it may be communicated to the legislatures of the several states, to the end that they may provide for its final ratification by referring the same to the consideration of a convention of deputies in each state to be chosen by the people thereof, and that it be recommended to the said legislatures in their respective acts for organizing such convention to declare that if the said convention shall approve the said constitution, such approbation shall be binding and conclusive upon the state. And further, that if the said convention should be of opinion that the same, upon the assent of any 9 states thereto, ought to take effect between the states so assenting, such opinion shall thereupon be also binding upon such state, and the said constitution shall take effect between the states assenting thereto.
Okay, so adding the language that comes in after Article 7, that's what this language right here ultimately becomes. So Mr. Gary seconded this, but the interesting thing is that the way they were moving this, and let's just give this a little pondering here. They're talking about actually moving forward to a convention of deputies instead of going to the state house. In other words, it was pretty well decided that the states would kill this, the state legislatures. At least they knew 6 would. So, if not more. So, as pushing this into this convention would force this, then they wanted to make sure that the states would be prepared to justify to the people why they weren't willing to form a convention, so that the people could basically elect their delegates or deputies, in the language here, to go and debate the Constitution and to determine whether they ratify it or not. This would have been the process of this ratification was a huge educational process, if you really think about it, because not too many people today even know the Constitution. But back in the day when the Articles of Association and Articles of Confederation were created, there wasn't a lot of time for people to debate them. It was really done in the state houses. So most of the people probably didn't pick them up and read them. those people who are questioning, what, you know, what the heck's going on? Why can't they do this? They may have picked up why, you know, the Articles of Confederation were so problematic, but I think most people didn't. So pushing this into a debate by the people or the people's delegates, what this literally did was it helped people become more reasonably informed to make a more informed decision, instead of allowing those who already had their biases and already had their prejudices, who were not going to be willing to recuse themselves, to vote on, or actually to kill this. So, in other words, this really gave, it provided both the water and the sunlight and the, you know, the nutrients to nurture this seed called the Constitution to basically, you know, poke its head out of the dirt and say, you know, let's grow this government, not grow it in an unconstitutional way, but let's make this government ours and allow us to self-govern ourselves, instead of, you know, allowing the state legislature to rule the general government as well as this government. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. All right. So Mr. Wilson then opined, after Gary kind of seconded what Hamilton said.
Mr. Wilson, this motion being seconded, it is necessary now to speak freely. He expressed in strong terms his disapprobation of the expedient proposed. He particularly the suspending the plan of the convention on the approbation of Congress. He declared it to be worse than folly to rely on the concurrence of the Rhode Island members of Congress in the plan. Maryland has voted on this floor for requiring the unanimous assent of 13 states to the proposed change in the federal system. New York has not been represented for a long time past in the convention. Many individual deputies from other states have spoken much against the plan. Under these circumstances, can it be safe to make the assent of Congress necessary? After spending 4 or 5 months in laborious and arduous task of forming a government for our country, we are ourselves at the close throwing insuperable obstacles in the way of its success.
Ah, now Mr. Clymer, so Wilson's from Pennsylvania, and his fellow Pennsylvanian, Mr. Clymer, basically said,
Mr. Clymer thought that the mode proposed by Mr. Hamilton would fetter and embarrass Congress as much as the original one, since it equally involved a breach of the Articles of Confederation.
Mr. King.
Mr. King concurred with Mr. Clymer. If Congress can accede to one mode, they can to the other. If the approbation of Congress can be made necessary, and they should not approve, the state legislatures will not propose to the plan to conventions. Or, if the states themselves are to provide that 9 states shall suffice to establish the system, that provision will be omitted. Everything will go into confusion, and all our labor will be lost.
Okay. Now, Mr. Rutledge.
Mr. Rutledge viewed the matter in the same light with Mr. King on the question to postpone in order to take up Colonel Hamilton's motion. No, New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, aye. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, no. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, no. Georgia, no.
Okay, so I didn't keep track of that. It looks like it failed, though, with just one yes.
Yeah, Connecticut was the only one.
Okay, so go ahead and then just kind of read through the remaining couple here. Just, you know, Hamilton, Williamson, and then Randolph.
Colonel Hamilton withdrew the remainder of the motion to postpone Article 12, observing that his purpose was defeated by the vote just given. Mr. Williamson and Mr. Gary moved to reinstate the words "for the approbation of Congress" in Article 12, which was disagreed to, no contest. Mr. Randolph took this opportunity to state his objections to the system. They turned on the Senate's being made the court of impeachment for trying the executive on the necessity of three-quarters instead of two-thirds of each house to overrule the negative of the president on the small smallness of the number of representatives branch, on the want of limitation to a standing army, on the general clause concerning necessary and proper laws, on the want of some particular restraint on navigation acts, on the power to lay duties on exports on the authority of the general legislature to interpose on the application of the executives of the states, on the want of a more definite boundary between general and state legislatures, and between the general and state judiciaries, on the unqualified power of the president to pardon treasons, on the want of some limit to the power of the legislature in regulating their own compensations. With these difficulties in mind, what course, he asked, was he to pursue? Was he to promote the establishment of a plan which he verily believed would end in tyranny? He was unwilling, he said, to impede the wishes and judgment of the convention, but he must keep himself free in case he should be honored with a seat in the convention of his state to act according to the dictates of his judgment. The only mode in which his embarrassments could be removed was that of submitting the plan to Congress to go from them to the state legislatures and from these to state conventions, having power to adopt, reject, or amend the process to close with another general convention with the full power to adopt or reject the alterations proposed by the state conventions, and to establish finally the government. He accordingly proposed a resolution to this effect.
Okay, so here he actually lays out very specific complaints. I mean, he's talking about the powers and duties on exports, the president to be able to give unqualified pardons. I mean, he's literally listing a list of grievances he has with what's in this Constitution.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so, folks, if you've never been told this before, be careful what you say because it can come back and haunt you, especially when you write it down. Madison wrote it down. So now, because I already told you what ends up happening in like 11 months or so, or whatever the time duration is from September all the way to June. Now, they actually, it's not even, I think it's more like 8-9 months probably, something like that. But anyway, as they meet in the ratification debates, many of these, and as a matter of fact, it's not that Madison was the one, because Randolph became a friend of the Federalists. He was testifying on behalf of ratifying the Constitution. I think it was Mason, and I think it was only Mason, but other people that had heard this little list that, you know, what about this and what about that? He actually had to go and lay out, you know, what those lines really meant and why he no longer had any reservations with those things. So you'll notice that as Governor Randolph, if you really think about it, at the very beginning of the convention, he spoke out a lot. And then as we started getting into the meat and the discussions and the debates of the very specific issues, Randolph wasn't piping in hardly at all. And now at the very end, now he's piping in because he's not necessarily happy. It's just I guess there's an old saying that it's kind of interesting how with the winds change, so do people's minds. Or, you know, I don't want to say fair weather friend or anything like that, but, you know, it's interesting how Randolph evolved through this process. Does that make sense? Because, you know, what was causing him to all of a sudden take this position? It was almost a position of contention, right?
Sounds like maybe at the end he started remembering all the things he thought were a problem and got frustrated. I'm not sure, but it sounds pretty like a change of
Right. So to me, when I hear people all of a sudden come out and be contentious, you know, and putting aside the things they all agreed on that they needed to put aside the Articles of Confederation, maybe the point in time needed to occur in his head that, hold on here, am I saying that the Articles of Confederation are far better than what we've got here? I can't say that, because we know that the Articles of Confederation are impotent. They've proven themselves as being inept. Why would you actually kill this one thing that actually makes it easier to make changes to it? Because of the amendment process. It's no longer unanimous. There were lots of reasons to say this is the far better way to go. But for some reason, and I'll just say, maybe he has a dark influence that kind of got a hold of him. Maybe his pride. I don't know what it was, but it almost became contentious. Colonel Mason became contentious. And, you know, I learned a long time ago from my parents that the spirit of contention is... have you ever heard that?
No, sir.
Okay, the spirit of contention is of the devil, because it's the devil that always wants us to basically become argumentative and contentious and so forth. It is the spirit of cooperation to try to find... doesn't mean that you're surrendering your common, you know, your positions, but being contentious is literally being negative. And being cooperative means that, you know, you're working through, you can still throw out arguments against, but you're still working towards a common end and a compromise, what have you. So when we look at, you know, what Governor Randolph was doing, it's almost he just got consumed with being contentious. But by the time the ratification debates come around, that's the spirit of contention was gone. And he had his share of humility and apologies to do, believe me. Because, I mean, he was the champion of proposing a dramatic change. I mean, we're talking about a very dramatic change of the framework of government by creating a separate judiciary president. I mean, creating a huge cost of this government to better tax people. So anyway, there was I'm sure he had more than enough serving of Crow as he finally changed his mind to becoming a champion for the Constitution in the last run in this saga. Anyway, so with that, we've kind of concluded. When we come back, we will be going into the admission of states and a few other topics, the amendment protection clauses, and so forth. So with that, folks, I'm G.R. Mobley, and we're Reclaiming the Republic. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and I can't say this enough. We can't do this without your help, and we're here to help you help us and help our republic. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.